Well, many Australian children know and love Gillian Rubinstein's sci-fi novels, including Space Demons, Fox Spell and Galax Arena. What they might not know is that under the pseudonym of Leanne Hearn, she's also published novels for adults that are set in a magical feudal Japan. Her series Tales of the Atori is wildly popular. It's sold 4 million copies worldwide and it's been translated into 40 languages. I didn't know there were 40 languages. Now Leanne has written a new novel set 300 years before that best-selling series. She's speaking here to Georgia Moody.
Leanne, this novel, Emperor of the Eight Islands, is the first in a two-part prequel to your much-loved Tales of the Atori series. What prompted you to write this novel?
In a way, it's not so much a prequel as something that kind of happened like that. I didn't intend it to be a prequel, but two things happened at the same time, which I suppose turned it into a prequel in the end. One was that I was in Iwate Prefecture in Tohoku in northern Japan with some friends, and they took me to see two types of folk dancing there. And there was something about seeing these dances, seeing the young men in their masks and their costumes, that gives you the feeling that you're looking back into deep time, that you're seeing something from a very ancient past. And as I was watching this, I kind of had the idea that I would like to set a novel back in that time. And around the same time, two fans wrote separately asking about someone who is mentioned very briefly in the final Otori book, Heaven's Net is Wide, Otori Takeyoshi. And some boys are talking about legendary heroes at the shrine, and they just mention him as the founder of the Otori clan. These fans wrote and said, why don't you tell us more about this guy? He sounds interesting. And so these two things came together, and I thought, well, I could write something that goes back to that era, set it in the same world, and try to capture some of the feelings I had when I saw these young men doing the deer dance and the oni dances, the monster dances in Iwate Prefecture.
Leanne, the central character of this novel is a young boy called Kazumaru. Who is he?
I suppose he's one of my classic heroes in that he's misunderstood and ill-used until he finds out that he has powers that he didn't know about. In this case, he gets taken over by two sorcerers and is given power by each of them and becomes quite a powerful sorcerer himself.
Before he becomes a sorcerer, he is a young boy, a 15-year-old, and his uncle wants to get rid of him because he's quite inconvenient. If Kazumaru becomes of age, he will inherit the estate that his father left to him.
That's right.
So there's a crucial hunting trip at the beginning of your novel. Tell me about what happens on that trip.
Well, on this hunting trip, they are going out in pursuit of an old stag who the uncle very much wants to capture. But on the way, Kazumaru begins to realise that he may not come back from this trip alive. And in fact, at the crucial moment, he seems to be falling to his death over the cliff. But the stag falls at the same time and breaks his fall. So he gathers up the skull and the hide of the stag and sets out into the forest with them, and then comes to the hut of the mountain sorcerer.
And who is he? Tell us about this mountain sorcerer.
He's called Shisoku. He's one of the old people who lived in the forest since ever and ever and who know all its secrets and all its animals. And he's obsessed with recreating animals. So he makes all of these fake wolves and bears and crows and all sorts of other creatures, and some of them work and some of them don't. And so his hut is like a sort of microcosm of things going on, things being created and things being discovered. Shisoku stepped slowly backwards and Kazumaru was drawn into the hut. He was not sure if he was in a dwelling, a workshop, or a shrine. There was scents of lacquer, camphor, and incense, not quite masking the stench of dead things. In the hearth, a fire blazed under an iron pot in which bubbled an unrecognisable brew. Carving tools and paintbrushes lay on a smoke-blackened bench. The floor was of packed earth, but at one end, in front of a sort of altar, rugs and cushions had been spread, surrounded by glittering lamps and candles. Carved figures of deities, all with lacquered and painted faces, stood on and around the altar, and on the wall hung many masks and animal heads, together with their skins. He could see at least two human skulls. He realized he had arrived at one of those places where the worlds mingle, like the place that had haunted his childhood dreams, where his father met the Tengu. He began to tremble, but there was no escape. Outside, the hut was surrounded by animals, both real and counterfeit. Inside was the sorcerer. Without knowing how it happened, he was lying before the altar, naked, covered only by the deerskin. He looked up at Shisoku with the same eyes as the stag, widened and resigned in the face of death. Shisoku gave him a drink of mushrooms and pine needles mixed with lacquer and cinnabar, which would ordinarily kill a man, but put Kazumaru into a deep trance. Time stopped. Kazumaru watched him take the antlers and the half-moon-shaped brain pan and begin to create a mask, chanting as he worked, some mysterious sutra that Kazumaru had never heard before. Slowly day turned to night. Outside, the animals stirred and cried out. It seemed to Kazumaru that a woman lay next to him. He was filled with fear, for he had never been with a woman, had avoided the knowing glances of the maids at Kumayama, suspicious of all they seemed to offer, wary of the ways humans hurt each other. But she led him on to embrace her, many times that night and the following ones, his cries mingling with the animals. He knew his body, his strength, his maleness were being used for purposes he did not understand, against his will. Nevertheless, his own lust rose to meet hers. In the day, he lay unable to move and watched Shisoku as he painted the mask with layer upon layer of lacquer and the red and white fluids produced by the lovers. He dried each layer by passing it through smoke from the incense, chanting a different spell each time. He made lips and a tongue from cured leather, painted with cinnabar, carved out hollows for the eyes and fringed them with black lashes cut from the woman's hair. He polished the antlers until they shone like obsidian. The moon waxed to full and waned into nothingness. When it was next half-grown, the mask was finished. Shisoku fitted it to Kazumaru's face. It clung to his features like a glove to a hand. He felt rush through him the strength of the stag and all the ancient wisdom of the forest. The woman came one last time. His cries echoed like the stag in autumn. She held him tenderly and whispered, "Now your name is Shikanoko, the deer's child." A distant memory came to him, a fawn, his father's voice, and he knew he would never take another name.
Leanne Hearn reading from her latest novel, Emperor of the Eight Islands. We follow the newly named Shikanoko, as well as a host of other characters, through the twists and turns of this epic story of emperors and sorcerers and powerful abbots. Leanne, like the main character of this novel, you've taken on a new name. Before your Atori series, you were best known as the children's author Gillian Rubinstein. Why did you decide to take on a pseudonym for your book set in Japan?
They seemed to be a completely new departure from the children's books. They were for an adult audience, and I suppose I just wanted to make a complete break with the past writer that I'd been. And also it's a very Japanese thing, which is very annoying for historians, to change your name when you come to a new stage in your life. So you'll find that a lot of Japanese historical characters and artists have many different names during the course of their life. And so it seemed to be something that would be interesting to do.
I know that you've studied Japanese and that you regularly travel to Japan. What is it that draws you so strongly to Japanese culture and history?
For some reason, I've been interested in it almost all my life, and I'm not really quite sure why. It just seems to, I can understand why, because it's such a hugely fascinating and rich culture and history. It's just something that you would never get to the end of studying and trying to understand and learning more and more about. And so that aspect of why is always really very hard to answer. My Japanese friends say, well, it's obvious that you were Japanese in a former life, but I'm not sure that I believe that.
As we saw in that excerpt, there's lots of sex in the Itori series and in this prequel. It seems to me like this world is seething with lust. Why is that?
I think it was something that I was quite interested in, even from the first thinking about the book, was this idea of lust as a force of nature, and that the world is sort of seething with recreating itself and reproducing itself, and the whole thing is a kind of seething turmoil of all animals seeking to reproduce themselves. And I think that aspect of nature that you get in Japanese writing and films is something that appealed to me very much, that nature is a very powerful thing, not always benevolent, often very dangerous and cruel, but it is the world we live in, and even though it's full of peril, it's also very beautiful. I think this book has even more sex probably than the Otori books, because it looks at the power of sex and of using that power of sex in shaping people's lives.
It's also a savage world, a world in which death is just around the corner, and you're not afraid to kill off central characters who we've come to care about. Is that an exciting prospect for a novelist?
No, I always rather dread it, actually. I hate that moment when you come to that point in the plot and you realise that things have converged so that this character has to lose their life. It's always very painful. But sometimes it is necessary for the plot. It's the way that you have set things up, and things have to come to their logical conclusions. So I don't think we can talk about specifics here because it will spoil things for people. But there are characters that I was extremely fond of that I didn't like to kill off, but it just seemed to happen that that was the way it was.
The female characters in this world are so constrained. They live at the mercy of these powerful warlords, and often they have to disembowel themselves because the honour code dictates it. Do you find it similarly restrictive when you're creating female characters, that they're so often powerless?
I think they have their own power, and I think that is what makes them fascinating to write about. Japanese history is very, very male-dominated when you read about it. Women don't get mentioned very often. But of course, men and women have had relationships always and always will have. And women have their own sorts of power in these worlds that maybe don't get recorded but are still very much there. So it's a sort of case of looking into poetry and literature of the time and looking at ways that women lived and how they were able to have influence in their lives. So I find writing against that constraint very interesting, very challenging.
Leanne, this is now the 8th novel that you've written under the pen name Leanne Hearn. The 9th will be the 2nd in the Tale of Shikinoko series. What is it about Japanese history that continues to inspire you?
Each time I think that I might be finished with this subject, I find something else that's absolutely intriguing. And I think, well, that would just make such a great base for a novel. It's endlessly fascinating to me. And one of the ways that I come to understand it is by writing about it. I think that we all do this when we write, that we write to find out what it is that we think about things and how it is that we understand the world.
Georgia Moody speaking to Leanne Hearn, the pen name of the author Gillian Rubinstein. She lives in South Australia and she's been talking about her new novel, Emperor of the Eight Islands, The Tale of Shikonoko, and it's published by Hachette. And didn't she read beautifully? That was the most marvellous reading, evocative reading of her prose.